may be seated. Good morning. This is the second argument of the morning for the Tuesday, January term. The case before the court this morning is the State of South Dakota versus Jonathan Kleintobe. Elizabeth Relegado is here on behalf of the defendant, Mr. Kleintobe, and the state is present represented through Paul Stensland. Each party will have 20 minutes for your initial argument, and then Ms. Relegado, you'll have 10 minutes rebuttal after the state finishes its argument. You'll receive a yellow light at 2 minutes to warn you of your time. You may proceed at this time, Mr. Relegado.
Thank you. May it please the court and counsel. We're here today because the life without the possibility of parole sentence that was imposed upon Jonathan Kleintobe for the charge of aiding and abetting first-degree manslaughter was an abuse of discretion by the sentencing judge. Given the unique circumstances of the case and given the unique circumstances of Mr. Kleintobe himself. Not only was the sentence an abuse of discretion, but this sentence of life without the possibility of parole for this first-degree manslaughter charge was a violation of the Eighth Amendment prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment. I can only assume that we're here because the court has questions, and I welcome them. I will utilize my time at this point, though, to outline my argument, starting with the Eighth Amendment. As I said before, the Eighth Amendment prohibits the imposition of cruel and unusual punishment. But as this court is aware that the question isn't as simple as that, this question turns on whether or not the sentence imposed is grossly disproportionate initially with the corresponding offense. When that prong is met, as it is in this case, the court then moves on to a review of similarly situated defendants within the jurisdiction. When that prong is met, as I would suggest that it is here, the court then moves on to a review of sentences imposed to similarly situated defendants outside of this jurisdiction. But first, we have to discuss this idea of gross disproportionality. And that is essentially a weighing of the gravity of this offense versus the harshness of the penalty. And I think we can all start off with the idea that a taking of a human life in any form is always serious. And it's always emotional. And on the scale of the level of criminality, it's always going to be relatively high. But this court and the legislature have made acknowledgments that there are some facts that make certain homicides more egregious than others. So to that end, the legislature and this court have divided the types of homicides into first-degree murder at the top of the list, followed by second-degree murder, then preceded by first-degree manslaughter, and then second-degree manslaughter. It follows that the penalty for first-degree murder carries with it the most significant penalties, which is the death penalty, which in this jurisdiction is rarely used, or the more commonly used life without the possibility of parole on a first-degree murder. The fact that second-degree murder takes the death penalty off the table is a small acknowledgement that second-degree murder on the level of criminality is slightly less egregious than first-degree murder. First-degree manslaughter, by contrast, requires no premeditation and even no actual design to cause the death of another person. And yet, when you look...
Counsel, I'm going to just ask a question there. In a case like this, is the court confined when we look at the circumstances of the crime at issue to the offense to which the defendant pled? When we have a situation like this, one where the factual basis statement submitted by the defendant supports a first-degree premeditated murder?
I think that's a good question, but I do think that given the plea agreement that was reached, and I think that the factual basis as it existed alleged facts that supported both a first-degree manslaughter charge and perhaps a higher charge.
Isn't that what, forgive me, I'm sorry.
I apologize.
No, I didn't mean
to. Oh. But no jury found him guilty of first-degree murder. He wasn't found guilty of second-degree murder. And so by accepting the plea to first-degree manslaughter, that is the level of the charge at which this the court was bound to determine a sentence, is my position.
And of course, it carries with it the maximum sentence of up to life in prison without the possibility of parole. So even though the parties by their agreement settled on the first-degree manslaughter case, similar to the question that Justice Tapani's asking, that doesn't bind the court in its role as a sentencing judge, does it, to treat this only as an unintentional killer? Couldn't the court consider the actual nature and circumstances of the offense combined with the factual basis statement that was agreed to by all both parties in trying to determine and assess the nature of the offense in this case?
I think that the court isn't bound to consider this to be a case in which the defendant didn't design to cause the death of another person. But I do think that when making a determination, especially on a first-degree manslaughter charge, the court has an obligation then to take a look at all the facts and circumstances around the alleged facts as they were laid out in both the factual basis and the state and defense's argument, but also then look at the particularized circumstances of this particular defendant.
One of the things, since you mentioned that, the way I read your brief, and you can help me understand it, maybe if I'm not doing it correctly, but I thought I saw two issues. You've talked a little bit about the Eighth Amendment argument, and that's fine too. We can visit about this. Obviously, you raised it, but I thought that you'd also raised the argument that the sentencing court abused its discretion. You just mentioned this notion of concept of individualized sentencing. That was a centerpiece for Dr. Cunningham's testimony. That was very much what a lot of his testimony dealt with. So when you say that, are you getting into the abuse of discretion standard? You know, court didn't weigh this right, and in this individual case didn't do this just right, or help me understand where that fits into our rules, please.
Thank you. And I think that this court has recently dealt with a similar issue. I think that the idea of the abuse of discretion in sentencing and then this Eighth Amendment, they kind of naturally intertwine a little bit. I think as this court has noted, and I believe I pointed out in my brief, the standards are quite different. I do think that the Eighth Amendment argument could be applied to all first-degree manslaughter charges, regardless of the facts and circumstances. And I do make that argument within my brief. But I also
make the argument. I'm just trying to figure out where your view that the court, you know, did something wrong in this individual case with the way it looked at certain factors, as you just kind of mentioned a few moments ago. Is that more of a discretion argument, perhaps?
I would think that it is, but I do think that it can play into this court's determination when looking at the level of criminality for the first prong of the Eighth Amendment argument. Okay. And I do intend to address that abuse of discretion as well. Going back to, I guess, when I was discussing the level of criminality, I think that this court, in any first-degree manslaughter charge, and particularly this case, there has been a determination that first-degree manslaughter, while serious, is not the most serious crime in the land. The penalty, by contrast, permits the imposition of the most serious penalty, save death, that is available to this court or any court. And this court has a long history of grappling with the circumstances under which that it is correct to impose a life without the possibility of parole sentence, and also what constitutes a life sentence. So in State v. Weicker in 1983, this court noted that a life without the possibility of parole sentence should be rarely imposed, and it should only be handed down when a offender has forfeited his right to ever be free again. Likewise, in Bolt and its progeny, the court again stated that a life sentence should only be imposed when the determination can be made by the facts of the current offense and the previous criminal history, that rehabilitation should be completely removed from consideration. And I think life without the possibility of parole has been deemed so serious a penalty by this court that in Lemley, the court distinguished between a life without the possibility of parole sentence and 350 years as a term of years. And this court actually noted that by the sentencing court imposing that 350-year term was significantly different than that court imposing a life without the possibility of parole sentence, because it gave Lemley the opportunity to rehabilitate. So even when we're talking an extraordinary amount of time, this court has consistently held that that is still quantifiably different than life without the possibility of parole. So I think Lemley clearly demonstrates the immense severity of the penalty. And when we are weighing out in the first prong of that Eighth Amendment argument, the severity of the criminal act versus the severity of the penalty, I believe that this court needs to view and has viewed in the past life without the possibility of parole as a very significant penalty.
As I read the sentencing transcript here, it seems as though, and I don't think the court maybe said it exactly this way, but it seems as though the court was intimating that this manslaughter was among the most serious manslaughter offenses that there could be. If that's right, and I'm sure you may not agree that's right, but if that's right, that could justify the maximum sentence under our cases. Tell me why you don't think that's right.
Well, I think that, as I stated before, I think that just viewing a first-degree manslaughter charge under the way the legislature has listed the available sentences, I think that there's a very colorable argument that a life without the possibility of parole sentence for any first-degree manslaughter charge violates the Eighth Amendment. So
it's a maximum sentence.
Correct.
So that as the legislature in creating the top end of that sentence has violated the Eighth Amendment?
I believe that there's a very colorable argument that that's the case, yes.
For all defendants?
Correct.
No matter who?
Correct. And in particular, Mr. Kleintoe. And I think that what is interesting here when we're talking about life without the possibility of parole, and I keep saying that because that's exactly what it is. There's no difference on a first-degree murder charge, life without the possibility of parole, and a first-degree manslaughter charge, life without the possibility of parole. So essentially, Mr. Kleintoe bargains for a lesser charge, and the state agrees to that lesser charge. And yet when he's punished as though he is still being convicted of a Class A or B felony, or as though a jury or a fact finder has found those facts to find him guilty of a Class A or B felony.
But counsel, go ahead.
Go ahead.
Go ahead. But counsel, didn't he agree in the plea agreement without any agreement to a cap of years? And doesn't that make him open to the maximum penalty under the manslaughter statute?
Under the manslaughter statute, that's correct. That is the available penalty. It's still my argument that a life without the possibility of parole sentence on a first-degree manslaughter charge is a violation of the Eighth Amendment.
But he had no cap of years agreement.
Correct.
In his plea agreement.
That is correct.
Thank you.
I understand the distinction you make between the charges, and I get that. And it strikes me that that's maybe a better argument for the legislature than what it is for this court. But do you have any authority that would specifically support the idea that that argument is supportable under case law, that there's an Eighth Amendment violation based upon the legislator's decision to create a life sentence without parole for manslaughter, discretionary versus mandatory on a first-degree murder conviction?
I don't believe that that's been specifically litigated in South Dakota. I would suggest that legislatures pass laws frequently that are found to be in violation of the Constitution, and I think that this sentencing law is no different.
In that regard, in the same vein as Judge Cutler's question, a defendant or anybody else can waive rights, of course, including constitutional rights. It happens in every guilty plea. Happened in this guilty plea. And among the rights that your client waived was the trial rights and everything that goes with it. But the court also talked to your client about the maximum sentence and how it could include life without parole. And your client understood that and went ahead and pled guilty. So I understand your argument that as a sort of a categorical matter, life without parole in all first degree manslaughter cases, it's unconstitutional. But is that available to your client in this case, given that exchange between the court and your client, during which it seems as though he said, yeah, I know that in this case, and I'm going to plead guilty anyway?
I think that anytime you're reaching a plea agreement, there are certain things that are able to be waived, and there are certain things that remain. And I think that this argument remains to Mr. Kleintobe despite his sentencing. We wouldn't be here had the court given him a term of years, which may have been more appropriate in this case. I think that in reviewing the sentence versus the crime, I believe that given this court's jurisprudence on life without the possibility of parole, that prong has been met, that the sentence is grossly disproportional. The other prongs that this court must review have also been met and have been addressed in more detail in the briefing. I'm going to move on to the abuse of discretion argument and attempt to circle back to the other two prongs as time allows. And so I guess what our argument that life without the possibility of parole violates the Eighth Amendment, but as I just said, we wouldn't be here had the sentencing court not abused its discretion when handing down the life without the possibility of parole sentence for Mr. Kleintobe. And I want to really just state that, as I said before, the death of any innocent person is always tragic, and it's always emotional, and particularly in this situation. But to make legal determinations based on sympathy for the victim or anger at the defendant is not appropriate for any court. And in accepting Mr. Kleintobe's guilty plea for first-degree manslaughter, the court took on the obligation of meaningfully examining not just the particulars of the offense, but the particulars of this particular offender. And the sentencing court didn't appropriately consider Mr. Kleintobe's intellectual disability, the abuse and trauma he suffered as a child, the relative culpability between himself and his co-defendants, his chances at rehabilitation, his level of remorse, and the fact that all of these factors that came together really diminished his own moral culpability and mitigated towards a term of years rather than life without the possibility of parole. By imposing the maximum term in circumstances where they weren't warranted, the court actually violated the legislative intent of the statute, and that reserves the most severe sanctions for the most serious combination of offenders and offenses. As the court has already noted, the possible range of sentence for a first-degree manslaughter is anywhere from zero all the way up to life without the possibility of parole. And essentially what that suggests is that the legislator intended for the majority of offenders to end up somewhere in the middle, with the absolute worst of the worst being reserved for that life without the possibility of parole. During the sentencing, the idea of Mr. Kleintobe being a person with an intellectual disability was addressed quite a bit. And none of that was done in an effort to argue that he wasn't legally eligible for a certain penalty. It was done to show the court the level at which Mr. Kleintobe functioned in the world and how he interacted with the world and the resources that he brought to the table. It was essentially done to shine a light on the fact that this man, or this boy really, had a level of functioning which would suggest that he couldn't have masterminded or been the primary planner of any murder plot. It was done to show that the state's theory was unrealistic. And the trial court agreed that Mr. Kleintobe was a
2 minutes, counsel.
Thank you. The trial court agreed that Mr. Kleintobe was a person with an intellectual disability. And I think that it was undisputed that he didn't meet his childhood milestones, that he couldn't keep up with his peers. And I don't think that he did this as some lifelong manipulation. That defies logic. When looking at what Mr. Kleintobe brought to the table in making the decisions that he made, the court gave no meaningful consideration to his intellectual disability. Likewise, the court did not
seem to contrast the facts of the case with the testimony. Was that outside of the bounds of his discretion to reject expert testimony and prefer its own view of the facts in terms of the nature of the offense? And if so, how?
I think when the undisputed testimony is that this is an individual that's not operating at age level, this is an individual that's supremely damaged, and a court continues to go along with a theory that defies everything that was presented over the course of 3 days, yes, I do believe that that's an abuse of discretion. I think that the same was done with the testimony about the abuse and trauma that he suffered and his relative culpability to his co-defendants, who were both ex-military, not intellectually disabled, not and engaged in a great level of planning, more than even was suggested in the factual basis that Mr. Kleintobe signed. I think that each of these things diminished Mr. Kleintobe's moral culpability, which means the overall, what he brings to the table. And I think that the court misunderstood that and actually found that his lack of moral culpability made him more dangerous in the community.
Isn't moral culpability a concept that's used most often in capital cases in mitigation? I'm not suggesting it has to be exclusively used that way. I haven't really thought a lot about it. But isn't that the principle? And I'm sorry, can she finish? Isn't that the principle use for that concept of moral culpability, deciding if someone gets the death penalty or not?
Let's tee that up for your rebuttal.
Thank you.
You can address that on your rebuttal argument.
Thank you.
Mr. Sweetland, before you start, I apologize. Judge Clark, I didn't announce you, and we're all certainly aware of your presence here in the courtroom, but I wanted to announce for the record that Judge Joni Clark is sitting with the court this morning. She sat with us on several occasions in the past. Thank you for being with us. Judge Kern recused herself on the case. You may proceed, Mr. Sweetland.
Thank you, Your Honor. At his sentencing, Kleintobe stood before the court and said that he was, quote, truly sorry for orchestrating Jessica Rehfeldt's death, and, quote, whatever sentence I get, you know I'll accept. So we're here today because Kleintobe didn't mean it when he said that he would accept his sentence, just as he didn't mean it when he said he was truly sorry. A defendant who, in a ploy for leniency, says that he will accept his sentence with no intent of doing so if the sentence displeases him, is thinking on a level and thinking ahead and planning on a level above intellectual disability. And a defendant who is not truly sorry is not a defendant who is amenable to rehabilitation. But that's what Kleintobe wants this court to believe, that he is intellectually disabled and that he can be rehabilitated. Neither argument warrants relief in this case. With respect to his alleged disability, this has become kind of a trendy defense. More and more we're seeing this raised in non-capital cases, such as Diaz, Patterson. Intellectual disability certainly arouses sympathy for a defendant, and people with genuine intellectual disabilities are deserving of compassionate consideration by the law. But it's also a label that is fraught with potential for abuse. So it's important to take a close look at any claim of intellectual disability so that undeserving defendants do not.
Can I stop you there, Mr. Sweetland? Forgive
yes,
me.
Yes, Your Honor.
You may be getting to the point where you want to talk about correction for the Flynn effect and other things that you spent some time discussing in your brief. My question is, particularly as it relates to the argument that correcting for the Flynn effect, this drifting of IQ scores over time for reasons that some people feel are need to be corrected, is that really an issue for us?
And Your Honor, I wasn't going to raise it. I was simply going to point out that his IQ score was an 80 when he was tested in his adolescence, which is in the low average range. And it's 10 points above the cutoff for intellectual disability. So I was just going to leave the Flynn effect discussion and that for what's in my brief.
Well, let me go right at a different question then. Can we determine as a factual matter, as a reviewing court, that he either did or did not suffer from an intellectual disability?
Well, I think the important thing for purposes of this sentencing and the issues that have been raised by Mr. Kleintobe is that the court gave him credit for having some kind of intellectual impairment, whether it was a full intellectual disability or borderline or something of that nature. The court did give him credit for that and took that into account and even mentioned that maybe this intellectual limitation, whatever it was possibly made worse by the abuse and neglect he suffered as a child. But the court found that overall, as it was in its discretion to do, that Kleintobe's role in instigating the murder and his, quote, pattern of calculated moves that he employed to carry it out outweighed the mitigating effect of this intellectual impairment of whatever degree that it was. And I think it's important to note that the court did look at the planning and execution that was required for this murder and found it inconsistent with intellectual disability. Kleintobe did not kill Jessica Rehfeld impulsively. Instead, he formulated a plan that enlisted others to do his killing for him. Kleintobe communicated with his co-conspirators on an adult level, not like a boy. These ex-military men are not going to be brought into a murder scheme by some boy. He communicated with his co-conspirators on an adult level and persuaded them to do his bidding. And above all, we see Kleintobe abstracting potential future areas of failure in his plan and taking preventative action to prevent the failure, such as reburying the body or staging the phony call with the Hells Angels contact. So this case is not at all like Lemley, where an intellectually impaired defendant was led reluctantly into participating in a murder by someone who was intellectually superior to himself. Kleintobe himself was the catalyst for this murder and was the mastermind behind it. And I think we've probably established from the briefing, and I think counsel has agreed that even if Mr. Kleintobe is fully intellectually disabled, as opposed to borderline or low average, that does not disqualify him from a life sentence. And this is a discretionary life sentence. So Mr. Kleintobe's other main point is that he is capable of rehabilitation. And this court has stated that a defendant's capacity for rehabilitation is a fact question for the court to be decided at sentencing. And even that rehabilitation need not be considered in every case. Nonetheless, the sentencing court gave Kleintobe a four-day sentencing hearing in which Mr. Kleintobe could put in whatever evidence he wanted. But there was nothing in that evidence in Mr. Kleintobe's history or his conduct after the murder that suggested he was amenable to rehabilitation. Though Mr. Kleintobe did not have a significant criminal history, he did have a long history of sociopathic behavior, including preoccupation with violence, death, aggression towards females, fire starting, and cruelty to animals. Despite sensing, since he was in his adolescence, that he was someone who would hurt somebody badly someday, Kleintobe did nothing to rehabilitate himself, to learn to control his impulses before they cost Jessica Rehfeld her life. Kleintobe was celebratory after Jessica's death and took tokens off of her, which he kept hidden in his house for a year after she was dead until he was arrested. And most disturbing is that his encounter with the reality of death, with seeing Jessica's bloody corpse in the trunk of Schneider's car, and when he buried and reburied her, had no rehabilitative or deterrent effect on Kleintobe. He continued to abuse women, prompting four separate women to file protective orders against him in the year after Jessica's death. Kleintobe tried to frame Jessica Rehfeld's boyfriend for the murder, and he has never revealed the identity of this accomplice who posed as the Hells Angels contact, and who was so instrumental in convincing Hirth to go through with Kleintobe's plan. So actions speak louder than words, and there's really nothing in Kleintobe's profile to suggest that he was a promising candidate for rehabilitation. And that's actually what Kleintobe's own experts had to say about him. They were equivocal about his rehabilitation prospects, and these experts described his sociopathic propensities as, quote, ingrained, and, quote, not the sort of thing you can psychotherapize out. So since they were unable to confidently declare him currently capable of rehabilitation, they asked the court to essentially postpone that decision, give him a term of years so that Kleintobe's rehabilitative progress could be addressed at some future date. Well, the court properly disregarded that methodology as speculative, particularly in light of testimony from those very same experts that rated Kleintobe's own rehabilitative prospects as, quote, guarded. So here the sentencing court properly erred on the side of protecting the public from Kleintobe's violent impulses for the remainder of his life. I'd like to address Justice Devaney's question real quickly. You asked whether the court is bound to consider this as strictly as a first-degree manslaughter. And I think that when we look at Rice, that might be one way that one could interpret this, the sentencing analysis. However, later on in Diaz, specifically paragraph 52 of the Diaz case, this court did talk about how you look at the offense conduct. So offense conduct is relevant to the consideration of what punishment fits the crime, regardless of what the charge is that the defendant has pled guilty to. And certain values underlie our sentencing system. Premeditation, the killing of youth and innocence, the killing of the defenseless, and lack of remorse are penalized most severely under our system, whether it's manslaughter or any other type of charge, murder charge.
Mr. Sweetman, can I ask a quick question on the abuse of discretion argument, please? How do we know? I mean, our standard review is abuse of discretion, which we've defined, as you know, to be a choice outside the range of permissible choices. And in addition to that, we have some more substantive rules that provide guidance to the court. You know the defendant, you know, in the defendant's life and the potential for rehabilitation, examine the traditional sentencing factors, rehabilitation, retribution, public safety and deterrence, and those sorts of things. What standards and how would we know if a court gives too much weight to one factor or not enough weight to one factor under our standard review or our rules that guide a sentencing court?
I think that is part of the court's discretion in terms of how much weight to give any one of the rehabilitative goals or the punitive goals or whatever the goals of sentencing. That is what discretion is. The court's allowed to do that. And as this court said in Talla, it need not give rehabilitation any consideration whatsoever. So there's a very, very broad range of discretion that the court has in terms of how much weight to give to any particular sentencing consideration. And then I think it would be up to the court to look at the transcript, to look at, you know, how much evidence did the court have to rely upon. What did the court say during the sentencing in order to gauge how much weight the court gave to these sentencing considerations? And I think if we look at the transcript in this case, we have a four-day sentencing in which essentially Mr. Kleintobe put in every bit of evidence that he wanted. The state itself didn't put much evidence in during that sentencing.
About that. Does that impact the review that we're talking about right now? The fact that the defense had expert testimony from a forensic psychiatrist and a forensic psychologist, and there was cross-examination, of course,
mm-hmm.
And that yielded whatever it yielded. But how do you see the state of the evidence from an expert testimony standpoint, maybe regardless of who presented it or who called the witness?
Well, basically, Jonathan Kleintobe had a four-day free-for-all in his sentencing, put in everything he wanted. But his own experts, as the court pointed out in cross-examination, they weren't able to get him across the line. They themselves talked about, well, we don't know right now. We'd like to look at this later. These are not conditions that just disappear. You can't therapize these conditions out. His prognosis is guarded. The burden was on Mr. Kleintobe. And he didn't prove that he has this intellectual disability. And his own experts, he certainly didn't prove that he's amenable to rehabilitation. So in light of the evidence that was presented at this sentencing, the court did not abuse its discretion in finding that Mr. Kleintobe is not amenable to rehabilitation. The court did give him credit for having some level of intellectual impairment, though not enough to explain his conduct in this case. The planning, the vicious premeditation that went into this murder, and it is a murder by any other name. Granted, he did plead to first-degree manslaughter, but this was first-degree capital murder, entirely premeditated, entirely organized and arranged by Jonathan Kleintobe. And but for Jonathan Kleintobe, Jessica Rehfeld would be alive to this day. It's all on him, and that's what the sentencing court found. Consequently, Jonathan Kleintobe is where he belongs right now, behind bars for the remainder of his natural life. And the state and the family of Jessica Rehfeld asked this court to keep him there. If the court has any further questions.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honors.
All right, Ms. Relegado, you have 10 minutes. Maybe you want to start, if you still recall Justice Salter's question.
The court asked a question about moral culpability and whether that is a more appropriate determination in a death penalty case rather than in a non-death penalty case. And I would suggest that the idea of moral culpability came about through the sentencings of death penalty cases, because essentially what the lawyers and what the experts were trying to do was inform a jury as to why this person and what resources this person brought to the table when making their decisions. And when you're looking at a sentence like death, which is the most severe penalty, it was an important factor for the jury to consider what level of moral culpability an individual has. I would suggest that as time has gone on, that idea of what resources someone brings to the table when making a decision has kind of bled over into the non-capital world, especially with the idea of individualized sentencing and evidence-based sentencing practices, which have become kind of the norm in the court system. And so I think it's completely appropriate when someone is looking at a possible sentence of anywhere between zero and life without the possibility of parole, that this concept of moral culpability, what did you bring to the table? What damage do you have that has prevented you from making good choices? I think it is appropriate for a sentencing court to consider, if that answers the question.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. I want to just go back and address a couple of the points that were raised by the AG, particularly with regard to the intellectual disability. And I wanted to address a point that you made in terms of, I guess, what was presented at sentencing and what was not contradicted by the state. And I think that the court made a finding that Mr. Kleintobe was a person with an intellectual disability. And although the level of his functioning was disputed during the sentencing, the actual diagnosis of an intellectual disability was not disputed by the state.
He says, I don't doubt some of those, that you have some of those diagnoses. I don't know. I guess that... Is that what you're relying upon for that? And perhaps you're right. I don't know.
And Your Honor, at the time of the sentencing, she actually did make a finding in a brief sentence, and it's within the transcripts that she found that he was a person with an intellectual disability and then moved on very quickly. And I think that that was part of what the issue was, is that in finding that he was a person with an intellectual disability or in accepting the testimony, she did have some issues with... some of the behaviors of the offense and what that showed Mr. Kleintobe's functioning to be. But I think that was, again, a misunderstanding based on the state's representation of the facts and not a strict reading of the factual basis combined with the level of Mr. Kleintobe's functioning. And when the aid...
Is a court confined to the factual basis? However, I presume that there was also evidence in the record from the reports of the investigative reports in general? And couldn't the court also rely on that additional information?
Yes. Also in this case, extensive suppression motion briefing was done. So the court had a lot of information in addition to the factual basis. But my suggestion is that the court bought wholesale the state's theory of this case, despite 4 days of testimony to the contrary.
Should anyone with any level of intellectual disability ever be sentenced to life?
I don't know if I'm in a position to make that that argument, but what I can tell the court is that a person in Mr. Kleintop's situation with his intellectual disability combined with the other traumatic factors of his upbringing and some of the other issues that he suffered from should not be sentenced to life without the possibility of parole. And I think that a main reason for that is that he is rehabilitatable. As the AG suggested, he had an incredibly limited criminal history, which consisted of virtually nothing at the time of this offense. He had not engaged in any meaningful rehabilitative therapies. He came from a family that had its own damage and its own problems. From the way he was conceived to his 15-year-old substance abuse ridden mother, to the abuse he suffered as a child, to his intellectual disabilities, to the massive neglect he suffered throughout his life. These are all factors that should have been considered, particularly when we look at the distinction between his co-defendants and himself. And the AG made an interesting point that Mr. Kleintop must have been able to communicate with these individuals on an adult level. There's nothing in the record that supports that statement. There's nothing in the record that would support that how he communicated with these individuals, the words he used, or specifically that he communicated with them on an adult level. And that's based on an assumption that somehow Mr. Kleintop was able to mastermind this whole situation. And what we know,
Mr. Earth gave a really lengthy interview when he was arrested, and he related a lot more information than is included in the factual basis statement, including a lot of details about who approached whom and the call and the voice on the other line and all of that stuff. So, I mean, you might not think it's very convincing, but I mean, there's something in there, isn't there, in the record that suggests that how he gives us some look on a cold record as to how he was communicating with these other men.
I don't disagree with that. I think what's missing from Mr. Hirth's interview is specifics about language that was used and how Mr. Kleintop communicated. What I'd also suggest is that obviously Mr. Hirth has his own motivations when speaking with law enforcement. His case is yet to be resolved. But what I think is really interesting is about what Mr. Hirth said about himself, which is that he was former active duty military. He reported being someone who occasionally did jobs for the Hells Angels. He currently was working, unlike Mr. Kleintop, who had never held a job, and he was currently in the reserves. He indicated that it was his plan to give Jessica Rehfeld rides to gain her trust. It was his admission that he coerced Schneider into becoming involved. He planned the means and method of the murder himself, according to his own statements. He decided that Jonathan Kleintop shouldn't be there. He then decided that Jonathan Kleintop should be present for the burial. He specifically stated that he didn't want Kleintop to go unscathed. He brought the knife. He brought the body bag. He brings the shovel when Jonathan Kleintop can't even bring an implement to aid in this situation whatsoever. He directs no one to say a word. Those are his own statements as well. And when we go then to what David Schneider's involvement was, he's also an ex-military individual with no evidence of an intellectual disability or mental illness. He doesn't know Jessica Rehfeld and is doing this purely on the word of Richard Hirth, according to Richard Hirth himself. He's present for the actual killing. He drives the car. He holds her down. And he chooses the burial site. And he also never says a word, and yet he was sentenced to 75 years. Mr. Kleintop, a young, intellectually disabled man, who by his family and undisputed testimony at sentencing is easily influenced. He's a follower. He gets obsessed with men who represent manly stature. He was obsessed with people who were in the military, and he wanted to please those individuals.
I have a question about what I'll call your unwarranted sentencing disparity argument. You make the comparison to Mr. Schneider and his sentence. But our sentencing scheme in South Dakota is an indeterminate sentencing scheme. We don't have the guidelines. We don't have ranges. We don't have the science and the statistical analysis that goes into calibrating offense conduct plotted against criminal history and arriving at a range. So does that limit our ability in some ways to really fully understand the dimension or review an unwarranted sentencing disparity claim?
I think it certainly makes it more difficult, but I don't think it makes it impossible, particularly when the disparity is as glaring as it is in this case between Mr. Schneider and Mr. Kleintobe. By all accounts, Mr. Kleintobe was not able to create or follow through with any normal plans, including following a recipe. So the idea that somehow he was able to go through and to calculate and plan this murder without significant help is unrealistic. I have just a little bit of time, but we've noted that the 4 days that were permitted by the defense to present this mitigating evidence cast doubt on the state's theory. The court and the state bought wholesale into the idea that they had from the very beginning, which was John Kleintobe was the mastermind. It wasn't borne out by the evidence for 4 days. And it may look by providing the defense that opportunity that this inquiry should end in terms of abuse of discretion. But I would suggest that by providing the defense that opportunity, the court had a lot more information. And by then ignoring a large portion of that, which categorically mitigated towards a lesser sentence, was an abuse of discretion. Thank you.
Thank you. Your time is up. I want to thank counsel for your arguments this morning. The case is now submitted, and the court will be in recess until tomorrow morning at 9 a.m.